Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Not only is there no such thing as free money, but depending on who you are and how much you want to borrow, money can be downright expensive. Fannie Mae tried to borrow $2 billion this morning, had to pay a pretty penny in interest for it, too. Because lenders are worried the mortgage giant might not be good for it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, online at shrm.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is the 20th of August, Wednesday. Great to have you with us. If you're thinking, wait, didn't we have a Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac crisis a month and a half ago, and didn't Congress pass a big bailout bill so nothing bad would happen? Well, yes, we did. And yes, Congress did. But bear with me while I tell you that now the worry is that the Treasury Department might actually have to use its bailout powers. Shares of the two government-sponsored mortgage companies gave up a quarter of their value on those fears today. Investors seem to believe that if Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson does step in with billions in taxpayer dollars, individual shareholders are going to be wiped out. But why do investors believe that? Here's Marketplace's Steve Henn in Washington.
Wall Street's betting if Uncle Sam steps in to help Fannie and Freddie, taxpayers will come first, shareholders will get the shaft.
Fannie and Freddie are so important to the mortgage market and thus to the housing market that we can't afford to let them fail.
That's economist Doug Elmendorf at Brookings. He's worked all over the federal government.
But it's very important that we think about the way in which the government can become involved so that the taxpayers don't end up bearing the risk of loss while the private shareholders gain the benefits.
Elmendorf says the government can offer the mortgage giants a loan, buy a stake in the companies, or do both.
The problem with a loan is that the upside potential, if the companies do well, is captured by the shareholders, while the downside risk, if the companies are unable to repay the loans, falls on the taxpayers.
That's a political nightmare. The other alternative is the feds take an equity stake in the companies. The feds would buy newly issued shares in Fannie and Freddie, diluting the value of old shares to next to nothing. That's exactly what Wall Street fears, even though taxpayers could profit if the businesses succeed.
Well, I don't want to speculate on what Secretary Paulson might do.
Fannie Mae's CEO, Daniel Mudd, appeared on Public Radio's Diane Rehm show this morning to reassure investors a bailout wasn't on the horizon.
They haven't offered anything, and we haven't asked for anything. I don't anticipate that we will do that.
Shareholders weren't reassured. After that interview, Fannie's stock continued to plunge. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The company that invented the online auction is rethinking its business model. eBay announced a new fee structure today. Never fear, you will still be able to bid on that deck of vintage playing cards or whatever it is that you collect. But starting next month, the company is going to be emphasizing its fixed price listings to help it keep up with the competition. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch has more now on whether users might buy into those changes.
Sellers used to pay up to 57 cents a day to list a fixed-price product on eBay. Next month, they'll pay just a penny. eBay hopes lower fees will attract more sellers and buyers. That will help it compete with online giants like Amazon. But the shift to fixed prices moves eBay away from its signature auctions. Online marketing consultant Kevin Heisler says the company has no choice.
A lot of buyers have become disillusioned, I think, with the idea that they're really not getting a great value because they can't count on winning an auction, and they're not sure that the auction is always going to be fair.
He says mom-and-pop sellers often prefer auctions because people tend to overpay.
When people buy at an auction, they have oftentimes that kind of auction fever where they'll pay more than what an item is worth So there is that dimension that has given sellers much more revenue through the long haul.
eBay pioneered the online marketplace. Its site gave smaller vendors access to the World Wide Web. Now those vendors are eBay's competition. Nia Hartman in Rossmore, California, says she doesn't bother with auctions. Instead, she uses eBay as a referral service.
eBay was good for looking for a variety of things, like a tuba mouthpiece or a wireless card for my computer, and I'd be able to see a whole bunch of different vendors and manufacturers, and then I would go to their sites.
Even with the lower listing fees, eBay still doesn't match its biggest competitor. Amazon lets sellers list items for free. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Here's a Hollywood drama that's been 8 years in the making. A group of 40-something television writers has settled the first of a slew of age discrimination cases. The settlement's going to cost the talent agency International Creative Management $4.5 million. There are still 21 more suits to go against other agencies, other producers, and other studios. And Marketplace's Renita Jablonski reports the writers aren't getting any younger.
Larry Mintz has a pretty impressive resume. He was a writer for hit shows like Sanford and Son, Family Matters, and Married with Children. Love and marriage may go together, but being 50 and a Hollywood sitcom writer do not. At least they didn't for Mintz. That's how old he was in 2000 when he joined other TV writers in an age discrimination lawsuit. Mintz says he stopped getting TV work in the 90s. It's a situation attorney Tony Siegel has seen many times.
We've known for a long time that our members' careers are unfortunately short.
Siegel is general counsel for the Writers Guild of America West. He says Hollywood is obsessed with young audiences, and older writers are being boxed out of opportunities earlier than ever.
Writers should be hired because they're talented writers, not because they are the particular type of people they are being asked to write about.
As part of the settlement with International Creative Management, the agency could be required to take part in a jobs program to promote the work of older writers. ICM's employees will also have to attend training seminars on age discrimination. Bob McCann is a business professor at the University of Southern California.
I think it puts Hollywood on call that, hey, this is an issue, and the major networks and production studios need to be aware that this is a serious issue.
Disney, Fox, NBC Universal, and CBS are among those still facing lawsuits. In Los Angeles, I'm Renita Jablonski for Marketplace.
Those worries over Fannie and Freddie didn't really slow things down much on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Iraqi officials said today they've reached an agreement with the United States to reduce the U.S. troop presence there. White House spokeswoman Dana Perino said it's not quite a done deal just yet, but any agreement would be a big step toward rebuilding the American presence in the Middle East. In his new book on that topic called A Path Out of the Desert, analyst Ken Pollack says the first step for the United States is to admit it has a problem.
When it comes down to it, for the United States, it's all about the oil. It's a hard thing to say, but you need to think about the oil in this way. Oil underpins our economy and the economy of the entire developed world. It is important to us because the loss of major supplies of oil would cripple our economy, but also because it would devastate the economies of our trade partners. And in the interdependent globalized world, we can't afford for that to happen either.
Once you get past the fact that we are there for the oil, there are other problems in that region that the United States will have to deal with to get a path out. There are demographic issues and political issues and socioeconomic issues. How do you unify all that in a theory that gets the United States out of the Middle East?
The Middle East has problems abounding. And, you know, the good news is that that is something that we and other countries, other regions of the world have found ways to address. Think about Europe before the Second World War. And it was the worst region on earth, the heart of genocide, of the world wars, of the worst slaughters, the worst religious wars, starvations, you name it. And through a process over about 50, 60 years, the United States helped the Europeans to basically completely reforge their own societies. Now, I don't want to suggest that what happened in Europe is exactly what's going to happen in the Middle East. Not the case at all, because it's going to be up to the Middle East to decide, the people of the Middle East to decide what kind of a path they want to take. But we've never worked with them to try to find a way to make it possible for them to reform in a way that they find palatable, nor have we really committed ourselves to this kind of an effort the way that we did in Europe, in East Asia, and more recently in South America.
It has to be said that you wrote a very well-received and very popular book 5 or 6 years ago that charted, literally, this is the title, The Case for Invading Iraq, that charted the way in. How do you now present yourself as somebody charting the way out?
Well, of course, the first problem is that while the book was very well received, it seemed to be very little read, including by the Bush administration. My argument was that you needed to make sure that you had taken care of al-Qaeda first. Don't take your eye off Afghanistan before you shift to Iraq, and a whole host of other points. In addition, I spent a lot of time in that book, the entire last chapter, talking about what would be necessary to rebuild Iraq. And I said this was going to be by far the most important and the hardest part, that we shouldn't do it unless we're ready to actually make the full effort to do the reconstruction. And of course, the administration did none of that.
You call the book A Path Out of the Desert. And I'm wondering whether the United States ever wants to get out of the Middle East. I mean, we need to be there for so many reasons.
Sure, but there's be there and then there's be there. Again, go back to Europe. When the Truman administration first committed the United States toward making the same kind of effort or a similar kind of effort in Europe after World War II, and of course there were a lot of people who said it couldn't be done and who said we didn't want to stay there and the public would never support it, all of which, of course, was proven to be untrue. But the simple fact of the matter was that over the course of time, by doing what we did make it possible to disengage from Europe. When you think about the Middle East, what our engagement is liable to be like at this point in time if we actually do help the region and develop states and economies that can actually meet the needs of their people. If we can do that, I don't think that we're ever not going to have a relationship with the Middle East, but at some point in time, that relationship is going to be very different from the one that we've had for the past 60 years.
Ken Pollack, thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me here.
Ken Pollack's at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. His latest book is called A Path Out of the Desert. Right after we got married, my wife and I had an upstairs neighbor we called Sasquatch, or Bigfoot. As you might gather, we could hear every step she took up there. We got our revenge, though. We had a baby, a loud baby. Fast forward 10 years, and the noise that kid made has become big business for the people who know how to handle it, acoustic consultants and contractors who specialize in soundproofing. Most of what they do is help bars and nightclubs keep the noise down. But residential noise complaints are on the rise, and many of them involve the thud of tiny little feet. Ashley Montite has more.
Jasper Twitchell is 4.5. He lives with his parents in a 450-square-foot one-bedroom apartment in Brooklyn. This evening, as a fan whirs on the windowsill, Jasper's working off some energy by bouncing a big inflatable ball.
And a three! Was high.
Jasper's mother, Adriana Velez, says the downstairs neighbors can probably hear the ball land. They've picked up plenty of Jasper's other activities through their ceiling.
Sometimes he'll jump off of the beds, and that's...
And land on the pillows.
And land on the pillows, but you don't always land on the pillows, and that's the problem.
Yeah.
When you don't land on the pillows, it's super loud.
Velez says the couple downstairs has complained a lot about Jasper running and leaping about late in the evening. At least they haven't sued. Some frazzled neighbours do. To build their case, they often hire acoustic consultants like Alan Feierstein of Acoustalog in Manhattan.
Usually when people can't get any sleep, they call me first thing in the morning. 9 o'clock in the morning, I'll come in, get messages or get phone calls from people who say, look, I can't take it anymore. I just had another sleepless night. It was unbelievable. It's like a herd of elephants up there. Tell me what I can do.
Feierstein goes to the apartment and assesses the noise, its type, its level, and where it's coming from. Sometimes he leaves his equipment with the client for days, the better to capture random squeals and stomps.
I take certain precautions to make sure that the person who is operating the equipment can't fake it and attempt to make the sound appear louder or come from their own thumping around.
Feierstein says an investigation like that costs at least a few thousand dollars. Adriana Velez says to sort out their problem, she and her husband staged a kind of intervention. Their neighbor met Jasper and told him to his face that he was keeping him awake. Velez says it seemed to sink in. These days, Jasper has an 8 p.m. noise curfew. But she says their neighbor also realized something.
Our neighbor just finally had the epiphany that you can't wrap them in bubble wrap at the end of the day, and there is no off switch.
Complaints about kid noise are up in various cities around the U.S., but in New York, apartment residents seem particularly sensitive, which perhaps isn't surprising. According to the census, between 2000 and 2006, the number of children under five living in Manhattan leapt by 31%. That's a lot of little feet and a lot of crying babies. Mason Wyatt of City Soundproofing says there's a fix for that. The noise sufferer can soundproof their ceiling or ask the baby's parents to soundproof their floor.
Doing a carpet underlayment is probably the least expensive for the money. Oftentimes, neighbors don't always see eye to eye on spending money.
Wyatt says he's been caught between the person who's hired him and the allegedly noise-making neighbor.
I've had people say, you can come in, but he can't. So they're not getting along that well, but they still want to get something done.
You may be able to tackle the acoustics in your own apartment, but other parts of the building are another matter. Adriana Velez says lately she's heard some new concerns.
Noise in the hallway, my son talking to my neighbor's daughter, yelling, running up and down the stairs, visiting each other. So that's the new frontier that we're facing that we have to manage next.
She says she's returning to full-time work soon so she and her husband can save for a bigger apartment, preferably on the ground floor. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Coming up, talking with CEOs about GMOs, that's genetically modified organisms.
Rather than the what if, it's the what is. And the what is 12 years, a billion plus acres of these crops being planted around the world, and absolutely no problems.
It's a conversation from the corner office, but first, let's do the numbers. Stocks went up today despite the dead weight of Fannie and Freddie. The Dow Industrials gained 68.6% to end at 11,417. The Nasdaq salvaged 4.2% to finish at 2389. The S&P 500 rose 7 points, also 0.6%, to wind up at 1274. Hewlett Packard shined up 5.2%. The biggest personal computer maker reported an 11% rise in third quarter profits, that top forecast. And there were banking gains despite Fannie and Freddie. Bank of America fattened up 4.3%. Citigroup pocketed 1.75%. JPMorgan Chase climbed 4%. So did Wells Fargo. Goldman Sachs predicted that oil will climb 29% by the end of the year. $149 a barrel was their estimate. That pulled up energy stocks. Devon Energy, the biggest independent U.S. oil producer, and National Oil Well Varco, the biggest maker of drilling equipment, each gushed up more than 6% today. The 10-year T-note rose. The yield fell to 3.8%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Clinton Global Initiative, convening world leaders from government, industry, and NGOs to commit to action on global challenges. ClintonGlobalInitiative.org.
Every day's Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In New York, the Conference Board releases its index of leading economic indicators for July. On August 21, 1911, the Mona Lisa was stolen from the Louvre. Of course, there is no longer a blank space on the wall. Leonardo da Vinci's famous painting was returned a couple years later. And Sex and the City star Kim Cattrall celebrates her 52nd birthday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Boy, there's nothing like a good discussion about tax policy to get the political juices flowing, huh? All right, I kid. But there is a debate over taxes happening this election cycle. Commentator and economist Glenn Hubbard's been listening, and he's noticed something interesting.
With all the bickering over tax policy between the two presidential campaigns, you might have missed an important area of relative agreement: keeping dividend and capital gains tax rates low. In 2003, President Bush and the Congress agreed to reduce the tax rate on dividends from as much as 35% to 15%. The tax rate on capital gains was also reduced to 15%. Many economists say these changes in tax policy raised stock prices and stimulated business investment. By reducing the bias against corporate equity financing, these lower taxes reduced leverage by non-financial companies. Even with all the turmoil we're seeing in financial companies, non-financial corporate balance sheets are relatively healthy, and that's cushioned the entire sector. Senator McCain supports the 2003 tax change and wants to make it permanent. After some to-ing and fro-ing, Senator Obama has said he also supports a low tax rate on dividends and capital gains. His economic advisors cleared up his position in the Wall Street Journal when they wrote that Obama now supports a 20% rate. Raising taxes on dividends and capital gains to this level would adversely affect investment in stock prices, but it's still low by historical standards. It's also a lot less than the tax rate the candidate proposes on the incomes of successful small business owners. This relative convergence, assuming Senator Obama's position doesn't shift again, is welcome. A recent important study by economists Raj Chetty and Emmanuel Saez shows that the efficiency cost to the U.S. economy of increasing dividend taxes roughly cancels out the amount of revenue raised. Our federal government needs to restrain spending to keep taxes low. And among taxes, keeping tax rates on dividends and capital gains low is in our long-term economic interest. That both presidential candidates are close to agreeing should be news.
Glenn Hubbard is the dean of the business school at Columbia University. He used to run the Council of Economic Advisors for President Bush. Send us your thoughts. Online is best. Marketplace.org is the website. Contact is the link. Eli Lilly announced today it's going to pay Monsanto $300 million to buy its bovine growth hormone business. Posilac is the brand name. Some dairies use it to get more milk out of their cows. You might know it better as RBGH. Perhaps you've seen those letters on milk cartons you buy, labels that sometimes say the milk inside doesn't contain any artificial hormones. Monsanto says it's going to concentrate now more on its straight agriculture business, a business that has helped it become the world's biggest producer of genetically modified seeds. 2 months ago, with commodity prices rising and demand for food growing, Monsanto announced a campaign to double crop yields for staples like corn and soybeans over the next 20 years.
The boss will see you now.
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, Monsanto CEO Hugh Grant. I sat down with him and his Scottish brogue last week at the company's headquarters in St. Louis, and I asked him whether that plan to double crop yields with the help of genetically altered seeds wasn't simply economic opportunism in the face of a food crisis.
No. I don't think so. I think there's a crying need for this. We think the only way you can double yields is by improving the use of water and improving the use of fertilizer. And the only way you can improve the use of water and fertilizer, so that a plant literally sips instead of gulps, the only way you can get that done is with the application of some of these new technologies.
Do you understand, though, the hesitation and skittishness some people might have, and some countries have, about using technology and agriculture in the same breath?
Yeah, I do. I understand the skittishness, and there's a piece of this you say, well, let's wait. We'll let the next generation figure it out. Our kids will tackle this one. I think what we've seen in the last, it's not even a year, what we've seen in the last 6 to 10 months is an urgency or the start of the drumbeats that say we are going to have to figure this out.
Why do you suppose people are so afraid of the technology that you sell?
I think with new technologies, there's always a fear of the unknown. And I think despite the fact that, you know, we've been selling these seeds since 1996, so we're now in our 12th year, I think agriculture as a whole is still largely unknown. So there's a piece of this is just basic education. I'll give you, for instance, cotton, the shirts that we're wearing. 8 years ago, cotton was sprayed 8 to 10 times. So you remember the old Hitchcock movie with the by Northwest and the crop duster? So the crop was sprayed 8 to 10 times to keep the caterpillars off. Today, the crop's sprayed twice because there's a technology in the leaf that when the caterpillars eat the leaves, they die. But six sprays and hundreds of thousands of pounds of pesticides have gone away. And I think there's some apprehension because that story really isn't told or understood.
Okay, but you guys have been selling these seeds for 12 years now, plus or minus.
Yep.
Agriculture has been around for millennia.
That's absolutely true.
12 years is a really short period of time to understand what some of this technology might eventually lead to. And that's where the complaints and the problems come in. We don't know what we don't know yet.
Yeah, but if you took that approach, you'd never do anything. And if you and I were sitting here today and said, so what are we going to do about the continued demand for food? A piece of that is we need to improve productivity on an acre. There's no new acres around the world. We're farming what we pretty much have. There's no new water around the world. We're farming with the water that we have. So I think this, rather than the what if, it's the what is. And the what is 12 years, a billion plus acres of these crops been planted around the world and absolutely no problems.
Do you worry at all about the rise of organic foods and people being more interested in more natural produce and products?
No, I don't. I think if you walk through any supermarket, there's a portion of that shelf is going to be organic, and that's just fine. And there's a big piece of that shelf is driven by quality and affordability, and a lot of the organic material is still pretty expensive. So as we think about it, we're looking at how you satisfy demand curves and how those curves are evolving. And in my book, we're going to continue to see a ramp in those curves. So there's a piece of this I think is going to continue to be driven by production agriculture.
You ever buy organic food yourself?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Hugh Grant is the chairman and CEO of Monsanto. Mr. Grant, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you for coming here today.
We've got more of my chat with Hugh Grant and conversations from other corner offices on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a couple of items, actually, to bear in mind the next time you need to fly someplace. First, that internet-free zone you used to enjoy while you were airborne, the chance to unplug and get away from it all. Yeah, that's gone. Today, American Airlines announced wireless internet service on some of its transcontinental flights, $12.95 for the whole flight. And as long as you're bringing money on the plane, pack a little extra if you fly United overseas. United said this week it's going to stop giving away food on its transatlantic flights out of Dulles Airport in Washington. You can buy it, but otherwise nothing, not even any free peanuts. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 68 points, 0.6%. The Nasdaq gained 4 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 lifted 7 points. That's 0.6% there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, speed dialing your way to an answer.
It's like having a smart friend available through your cell phone that can answer any question for you 24 hours a day on any topic.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.